Welcome to part three of the Facts About the Vax on the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting podcast. I'm Dr. Elliot Berlin, and I'm here with our co-host Maria Bullen and our guest pediatricians, Dr. Carly Wilbur and Dr. Jay Gordon, continuing our discussion about childhood vaccines.
We talked about polio a little bit, if we can get a little bit deeper into polio. The wild polio is a virus. Polio is a virus.
Yes. Typically, a mild case of polio would give you fever, headache, vomiting. As it progresses to a more serious case, limb pain, muscle weakness, and paralysis of the muscles, whether it's a leg, wasting of the muscles in that leg. These kids used to end up in an iron lung, which is an old world version of a respirator because of the paralysis of the respiratory muscles.
And today, are there still cases of paralytic polio here?
In the United States, no.
Since when?
1985.
Some people say 79, some say 85.
There was
CDC
one.
CDC reports one case. I saw one thing reported one case in 2005.
An Amish traveler who went overseas.
Canada, I think it was.
No vaccines. They had no vaccines. Right.
So the disease still exists. It exists, but we're on the verge of worldwide eradication.
And again, because of vaccines.
Because of vaccines. The virus 100%. Didn't go away. There is an argument that I don't agree with, that for a long time we classified every single paralytic disease as polio, and a lot of viruses made their way to the central nervous system. I don't really believe that. I think that polio was a distinct set of viruses. It caused tremendous suffering and death, and that the vaccine is a good enough vaccine to have been around and to stay around. Whether or not your healthy American child needs that vaccine is up for debate. There are some people who say that prior to September 11th, 2001, there was some thought about removing the polio vaccine from the routine schedule. I don't know that as I don't know if that's true. But after September 11th, where people were worried that terrorists would drop polio on our heads, which would damage about, you know, hurt, have more chance of hurting your dog than you, no vaccine will ever be removed from the schedule. Smallpox has been removed. 25 years after smallpox was gone, we removed it.
But as far as you know, no known significant side effects from the polio vaccine?
Well, that's an interesting question. There's a disease entity called PANDAS, also called PANS. It's a sudden central nervous system tick disorder. Ticks, obsessive compulsive disease. It happens. We used to think it happened only after strep infections.
Isn't that what the S is for?
Yeah. Pediatric, and that's why they changed it now to PANS, and the S now stands for syndrome, I think. I'm not sure if the S ever stood for strep.
I think it's pediatric autoimmune neurodevelopmental associated with
streptococcus. Yeah. Anyway, this is not to get too complicated.
Let's not.
But there are children who, after infections and after other exposures, develop sudden OCD and tic syndromes. A couple of publications, not well-done research, but publications in reputable journals, showed that after the polio vaccine, some kids who had PANDAS had reactivation. These are the kind of things that I read that give me pause, because I have an email box with scanners that toss case reports at me every day. A case of a child who got this vaccine and this happened. Or a group like the Journal of Neurology article about multiple sclerosis and so on. And they cause my discussions with parents to be fuller. Are there no side effects in the polio vaccine? Like I said, I don't do anything that doesn't have side effects.
Wouldn't that be an argument for vaccinating earlier? So if a child had already been diagnosed with PANDAS and then they get the polio vaccine, it could reactivate. So why not get them immune before they ever have a chance to get PANDAS?
The question is how early and how do we clump vaccines, and what proof do we have that the safest way to do it is six at a time? I mean, the challenge to me is, do you have any proof that delaying vaccines is safer? No, I don't claim to. I have some experience, what I consider to be some logic or common sense that it's better not to do things six at a time, whether it's giving antibiotics or doing surgery or giving vaccines six at a time. But there is no proof that it's dangerous to give six vaccines at a time, but there's no proof that it's the safest way to do it. And if we can't prove that it's the safest way to do it, shouldn't we have a discussion amongst doctors and patients about how we'd like to do it? How are you most comfortable? Because if a parent is not comfortable after the hepatitis B vaccine or after the six vaccines at 6 weeks of age, as I said, I really think we run some risk of losing them, of having them be much more resistant than they otherwise would have been. I have an unusual practice. I mean, it's not like most people's practice. A lot of people come to see me because they are very much vaccine hesitant. They're not anti-vaccine. They come in and they say very specifically to me, we certainly want to give him vaccines. We travel a lot. We just don't want to do all six of them when he's 2 months old. Is there another way to do it? My answer is yes. And that yes answer immediately turns me and a few other doctors like me into outcasts. Suddenly we're anti-vaccine. No. We're not anti-vaccine. We are merely saying that this is a medical intervention worthy of discussion, that considering it to be etched in stone, because that vaccine schedule, as you know, has changed since you've been a resident, since you've been a pediatrician.
HPV vaccine didn't exist when I started.
And we've added vaccines, and as you know, we're going to be adding more vaccines in the near future. We've withdrawn some vaccines and then replaced them. The measles vaccine has had, I don't know how many different versions. The polio vaccine. Paul Offit, who is the Dr. Vaccine. Paul Offit's first book was about the polio vaccine disaster. You know, we make mistakes. So parents have a right to know all of these things.
What about varicella?
Oh, good one.
Thank you very much.
Finally, one I can say I had as a kid.
You had chickenpox.
I had chickenpox.
You were unvaccinated.
I'm a survivor.
There was no vaccine.
Right.
Even then.
Yes.
No.
When did the varicella vaccine come to be and why? Because I had it. Did you?
I was there.
We all had it. Everybody
I was there.
Table.
It was in the. So, it was invented for kids. Chickenpox is a again, you could call it a benign childhood illness, okay? It's not. I mean, any virus can cause everything from encephalitis to death. Every virus can. And because the outbreaks of chickenpox were so huge, it went through the whole first grade. There were high profile complications.
But I don't recall
but the real,
being
but the real
worried
problem,
about it.
The real problem were the kids who are on chemotherapy or high dose steroids for asthma, who were therefore immunocompromised. And this was not a rare phenomenon. There were a fair number of kids, you know, getting cancer treatment, a fair number of kids who needed higher doses of steroids for asthma. And when they got chickenpox, they could die from it. So the vaccine was invented for relatively narrow reasons and used for a fairly long period of time for those narrow reasons.
There was another high-risk population, women who had never seen chickenpox before who would get it in their first trimester.
Right. During pregnancy, chickenpox can damage a fetus. It's if you get chickenpox during pregnancy, week 12 through 15, about 5% of women can have a damaged fetus. I mean, it's a pretty large number. 1 out of 20. First you have to be non-immune, then you have to get chickenpox and so on. But it's there. But for years and years, the drug company, came to the American Academy of Pediatrics conventions, and they said, we can't afford to keep making this vaccine. It's got to be a universal vaccine. And they were laughed out of the convention. One of the other heavyweight infectious disease doctors, a guy by the name of Brunel, Phil Brunel, who used to run the division of ID at Cedars-Sinai, and who is now the editor of the Journal of Infectious Diseases, I think it's called. Philip Brunel laughed at them in print. They said, until you can show some real benefit to this vaccine against this relatively benign childhood illness, you know, go away. I mean, he was quoted numerous times as telling this was a silly idea. And then somehow, late 80s, whenever it was, not only did Dr. Brunel flipped, and a lot of other big infectious disease doctors flipped. And they said, you know, it is true that the average American family loses 4.2 work days and it costs billions of dollars. And they showed pictures of children with the worst chickenpox in the world. And that vaccine became a universal vaccine in the United States. But in Europe and in many other parts of the world, that vaccine isn't given routinely. And the reason that it isn't given routinely is that chickenpox, as we all know, is a virus that you get, when you get rid of chickenpox, it still lives, simplistically speaking, in your nerve roots. It remains quiescent, dormant, being kept in check by a healthy immune system. As you get older, 50, 60, 70, 80, or if you get immunocompromised, HIV, homeless, poor health, that vaccine can reactivate, go right down your nerve roots and cause shingles, which is a miserable reactivation of that same chickenpox virus.
Well, that will happen. That's not just from the vaccine.
No, from the disease.
Oh, okay.
It can also happen from the vaccine, but it happened from the disease. So in Europe, they made this calculation. They said, look, being exposed to kids with chickenpox keeps your antibody level up. Your kid gets chickenpox, your antibody level goes back up again, and your nephew gets chickenpox, and your children's six friends. So people went through their whole lives with a high level of antibodies against varicella. And the calculation in Europe was that eliminating varicella from this end, from the young end of the life spectrum, created more problems for older people than it solved for younger people. Let kids get chickenpox and move on, form an antibody level. It's a complicated discussion.
And you didn't get shingles at a younger age. I got it last year at 38.
It's a complicated
healthy.
Discussion
I got
because
it last year.
The vaccine
it was not fun, and I was immunocompromised. Yeah. I guess because I was breastfeeding, it was very painful at the time. Got through it, but so I think that's kind
you're
of
you're supposed
sparked
to get chickenpox younger.
Postpartum, I got it younger.
But there's a full court press going on in Europe right now to get that vaccine approved in all countries in Europe or to make it an EU-wide vaccine. But there's great resistance because they're saying, look, the concern is losing that exposure.
So
for
I wish my nieces and nephews had had the
but it, but it's not
to
a simple discussion.
My immunity.
It's not a simple discussion because. You know, there's like any virus. When you have an outbreak of a virus, you're going to get complications. So, you know, I don't like chicken pox. And when people, you know, call me up and they got a 2 or 3 year old and they say, my friend's child has chicken pox. Should we go expose our child? I say, well, yeah, I'm supposed to tell you should, but you know what? I hate making kids sick on purpose. Okay. And certainly it's not, I'm on legally shaky grounds if I say, yes, go get chicken pox.
Pucks.
So I still think it's probably a good idea, but
eBay.
The thing that kills in chickenpox is not the virus; it's the complications. It's the pneumonia.
Right.
And then when I was a kid with chickenpox, we didn't have community acquired strep infections, resistant strep infections that could, or staph infections that could. 200 on average open pox all over your body. That's bad news. That's an invitation for really invasive and aggressive germs to just come on in.
That didn't exist when you were a kid?
It wasn't community acquired. It was mostly...
No, but you know, another funny aspect, not so funny, another unusual aspect of what we do for a living
antibiotics.
Is we created those bacteria.
By antibiotics.
You know, I mean, that's a...
Well, overuse of antibiotics.
Yes, I'm sorry. Not
yeah. Yeah.
We, inappropriate I mean,
so
use of antibiotics.
So all of this is all just so interwoven. We, you know,
even
we...
in the food chain. I'm
but that's only, in,
the
that's
food
only
chain.
In retrospect that it was an inappropriate use of antibiotics.
No. We knew back. No. We knew we would prescribe amoxicillin for every kid with a cold or penicillin.
But,
we knew it's still
didn't
being
know
done
you're
today.
Going to create superbugs.
I overprescribe antibiotics every winter because I just do.
I know. I have friends that sneeze and then go get a Z-Pack because they can't.
Wow.
I like to think
and
I do better
that,
than that.
Some of that is the consumerism of medicine. You know, patients come to me with a man-made deadline, like we're going to Disney World and now he's got a fever and we're leaving in 48 hours, or the bar mitzvah's this weekend and can't you just give him something? You know, it happens.
We give in. I mean, if you really were a great doctor and practicing great medicine, you wouldn't give in to any of those requests because it's wrong.
Hepatitis A?
at best, it's nausea, vomiting, fever, jaundice, or rather fever, abdominal pain, and at worst, jaundice. Terrible, painful jaundice, meaning the liver is failing temporarily. Clotting factors are made in the liver, so that interrupts that production. It's dangerous, probably not deadly, certainly inconvenient, and it's viral, so an antibiotic won't help you if you get sick.
So we just support you and keep you healthy.
Therapy, IV hydration, and support for whatever products the liver can't produce at that time.
Unlike B and C, it's not permanent. I mean, B and C can become permanent liver infections. Hepatitis A is a transitory, unpleasant virus, which poorly treated certainly could cause complications, could, I would guess, lead to dehydration if you were really poorly treated, and I'm sure it happens in the developing world.
How does it spread? How does it spread?
That's fecal-oral. It's the guy who
dirty hands.
The waiter who didn't
but you
wash
can
his
get
hands
hepatitis
well.
A from eating in a restaurant. It used to be this vaccine, even in the time that I started practicing until now, this vaccine has changed its stripes. It used to be only for travelers who were traveling to endemic areas, Far East, Middle East, Mexico, sort of thing. And now we give it to everybody because it's cheap, it works, and it cuts down on illness. And
so
it
is
has
hepatitis
very few.
A lot less common now?
I think it is. I mean, that it's 91%.
I've only seen it once
decreased.
In a child. That was a long time ago. It was right in my first couple of years of practice, 1980 or whatever it was. And I know of adults, a couple of adults who got it while they were traveling through Europe, and one of them ended up in a hospital in Italy on an IV for a couple of days, and that certainly ruined their vacation. But I almost never see hepatitis A. On the other hand, it's one of the vaccines. I tell people, if you're going to be traveling extensively, your chance of getting hepatitis A are not great, but they're a lot greater than they are in the United States. And that vaccine looks to me to be, as harmless as a vaccine can be. I'll bet that if I did research, if I went to Medline, and I haven't done that, and I looked up hepatitis A adverse effects, I could find dozens of case reports of problems with that vaccine. But while those dozens of case reports were being generated, we gave hundreds of millions of cases of doses of that vaccine.
It's relatively safe.
It's relatively very safe. I've gotten two of them myself.
Yeah, since its introduction, 91% decrease in the number of hepatitis A cases that we see.
In the USA.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike. Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash. Let's talk about HPV, the human papillomavirus.
This vaccine got a bad rap because people think they can behave their way out of being exposed, and it's not necessarily true because kids don't have a good sense of what's safe, and there's only so much time in a well visit with a young teenager, and there's a lot to discuss, and you can't necessarily get into the nitty-gritty, and sometimes the parents just won't leave the room.
When do you give the HPV?
It is recommended anytime between 9 and 26 years old. So to give a vaccine that protects against what is most commonly transmitted through very intimate naked contact or sexual contact at 9 years old, that does put me off a bit, mm-hmm. having that discussion with the parents. I will say this vaccine is available for your 9-year-old. I don't know that we have to do it right this second, but it is available. I will typically hold off and give this vaccine, and this is not... admittedly, this is not backed by scientific evidence. This is my own bias as a mother of daughters. When they get their periods and they no longer think boys are gross and they're getting a little curvier and it's a relevant conversation, I use this vaccine as sort of a jumping off point to discuss what's safe behavior, what's not safe behavior, and here's one more layer of protection.
And so it's primarily sexually transmitted.
Intimate contact.
Intimate contact. And what happens when you get it?
HPV, the virus invades certain cells in the body and can help encourage them to become cancerous.
Which
to be fair, when you get it, I don't remember the percentage, but isn't 90% of people, I mean, don't they just clear the virus like any other?
Many.
Because I really don't remember the number. I should have the number.
What do you mean by the 30s?
By the age of 30.
You're saying most people have been exposed by the age of 30.
And have, but also clear it by the age of 30. In their 20s, it has the highest
rate. Does that make you immune to
those statistics come from people who get regular pap smears. That's the only way to know. It's the people who aren't getting regular care or who don't know to, who are going unchecked, aren't getting pap smears. Or, you know, the screening for the other cancers, granted, numbers-wise, they're not as many, but other cancers that HPV can cause, head and neck cancers, rectal cancers, these penile cancers, there's no screening for those.
So
for males at this point can't get screened for that, and they're
correct.
Cannot
they can
get
carry
screened.
It, but they can,
they are the only ones who can get penile cancer. As a matter of fact, but yeah,
interesting.
But they can get throat
if they know to. It's not routinely done.
Are you saying throat cancer or throat screening?
I don't know.
Head and neck cancer. You can get it. Those viruses can cause cancers. The overstatement of the number of cancers caused isn't fair. If I had my choice, if somebody said to me, you can either offer HPV vaccination, mandatory HPV vaccination or mandatory pap smears, I don't think any doctor would disagree that it's pap smears.
But is pap, I'm just confused, because is pap smears is showing you cervical changes.
Cervical only. It doesn't check. I mean, you cannot check for the others. They're not screened the way that pap, that cervical cancer is screened for.
So Dr. Gordon, you're saying if you were only concerned about cervical cancer,
if I were only concerned about health,
I'm saying if
somebody said we got our choice, we can either mandate pap smears at certain ages and at certain intervals, or we can mandate HPV vaccines. I'd say mandate pap smears for heaven's sakes, even though that's an invasion of that's
personal
not
space.
Correct. Yeah,
is but, that because the other types of cancers are so rare? From
they're
HPV?
They're extremely rare. The HPV vaccine doesn't prevent all of them. But again, it's, you know, I would love to simplify this discussion, but it can't be simplified, because I think that each individual parent, and often in consultation with a 16-year-old girl or boy, or a 13-year-old girl or boy, maybe that conversation is not easily held. Each individual parent should know the risks and benefits of the vaccine. The risks of that vaccine are grossly overstated. There are high-profile cases where somebody says that they had the vaccine. There are reported 100 deaths from that vaccine. Mm. Now, I don't think that can be in any way proven. I don't think that's official data. But that number floats around. That's like that same people talk about. We've saved 42,000 lives this year because of vaccines. You made the number up. You made the number up. I think they made up the number 100 deaths from the age. I think that vaccine, like any other medical intervention, can cause severe side effects. I think that it probably has. I think that it's such a complicated issue that it needs a discussion rather than people are being scared. You know, the hepatitis B vaccine was declared the first vaccine against cancer. Wow. Okay. The HPV vaccine is now declared the second vaccine against cancer. It's a vaccine to prevent warts, and yes, there are certain types of cancer it can make less common, but it hasn't been around long enough for us to really know that it's going to greatly diminish. It certainly isn't going to change the incidence of cervical cancer the way pap smears continue to. And my fear is, heaven help us, if we have a generation of kids who get a hepatitis B vaccine and an HPV vaccine and feel comfortable with unprotected sex.
Well, that's the responsibility of the teacher, the person who's talking to them about the vaccine. They do need to know that they are not entirely protected. Good protection, better than without the vaccine.
But it's illogical to assume that teenagers will, no matter how good the teacher is.
So does that mean that making condoms available to kids will also make them go ahead and have sex?
But condoms are the answer. No. What I meant was that they would skip.
But that's the same logic.
Skip the screen. No. I'm saying they would skip the screening. No, I think every step should be taken to prevent the transmission of diseases. And that could, in many, if not most people's opinion, include the HPV vaccine.
When I give birth control pills and when I give the HPV vaccine, I caution these girls and young men that this is not 100%.
You give the HPV to boys and girls?
Yes.
Are they both at equal risk?
Good question.
But you cannot get the girls clear of HPV unless you vaccinate everyone, because that's where they're getting it from.
So you're vaccinating the boys to protect the girls?
And to protect them from genital warts, penile cancers, rectal cancers, and head and neck cancers.
But more likely to protect the girls.
However,
the numbers are really, you know, the numbers were put together. Obviously, the money is in, the drug manufacturer has the money to put out not only the promotion of the vaccine but the research. So the numbers are questionable, but it's possible. You know, my problem with the HPV vaccine is that I was initially nothing but opposed to it. I still give it very, very sparingly. I mean, very, very sparingly. But I was initially 100% opposed to it. But if you do any kind of reading and you've got an open mind and you got any kind of medical integrity, you realize that, yes, HPV transmitted can lead not just to cervical cancer but to head and neck cancer. How much? I don't know. I've read as much as I can read, and I can't get the numbers right. I can't get numbers that make sense to me. All I know is that it is not the discussion that the promotion makes it out to be. Mm-hmm. Like every time you vaccinate a boy, you've saved a little girl's life, or an angel gets its wings, or something like that.
Would you add the HPV vaccine to that same list that isn't very effective?
Not at all. The new HPV vaccine that just came out this year, the human papillomavirus, which is supposed to protect from the germs that cause cervical cancer, head and neck cancers, rectal cancers, that went from only having one brand name only has two, a divalent vaccine, only two germs in it. And the one that we use in our office has four, but they don't even make it anymore. Now we started buying the one that has nine. And so
HPV
now the
nine.
HPV, actually, it prevents against 90% of cervical cancers and 90% of genital warts. It's really very good coverage.
Okay.
Well, why don't we end up our list with pneumococcal meningitis?
No, meningococcal.
Meningococcal meningitis.
The pneumococcal we discussed with Prevnar. There's a brand new vaccine for one of these. Very exciting. This is a bacterial illness that is rude. It is mean. It is fast, invasive, and can be fatal. 15% of patients will have permanent damage. 20% will die from this. The first vaccine came out, the current Menactra vaccine, again, product placement, sorry, I get no money from the Menactra people, came out in 2005, and then a second dose was recommended come 2010. The vaccine prior to this one was Menimmune, and that only had like a couple years worth of protection. And so we would give it to kids when they first went off to college to live in a dorm. And then you would just hope that they moved into a private apartment by junior year. I don't know. It just really didn't keep. It didn't help after that. So about half of the cases of meningitis are caused by the four serotypes, half of the cases of meningococcal meningitis, this particular germ, are caused by the four serotypes called ACY and W135. And these are the ones that are contained in Menactra. So you're talking about 50% coverage. I can give you pretty good coverage against this really horrible illness that your, 18-year-old who has done such a good job and made it to the honor roll going off to college to start word is bright future, you would hate for him to be struck down. And especially these kids don't have their moms around. You know, they feel like they have the flu and they stay in bed, and then 12 hours later, they're done for. So this moves fast, and it's not always declarative at the beginning that it's going to be such a terrible illness. So only recently this year, new vaccine for meningitis, this same germ, meningococcal meningitis, but the serotype B was introduced, and that pretty much covers the other 50% of what causes meningitis in college-age kids for the most part.
So now very effective.
Well, it is brand new, so post-marketing we have yet to discover.
They had an outbreak of that particular type of meningococcal meningitis at Princeton right around Thanksgiving. Was it last year or the year before?
In 13 or 14. Well, the one at OSU in my neck of the woods was 2009, but yours, the one at Princeton.
No, but I'm talking about the one what's the new vaccine? It's B, right?
B, meningitis B.
And there was no vaccine, and they had, I believe, a couple of fatal cases at Princeton right around Thanksgiving. And there was an experiment, there was a vaccine given in Europe that they brought over here very hurriedly. And with all of these kids exposed to meningococcal meningitis at Princeton, and Thanksgiving coming up, and 7, 8, 10, 12, I don't remember how many cases, including a fatality or two. You know what they did? Quarantine the entire school? No. They sent the kids home for Thanksgiving. Which I thought was the most medically disingenuous thing that anybody has ever done. I mean, this is a disease that every doctor respects. I haven't ever seen a case of meningococcal meningitis in private practice in 36 years, and I bet you haven't seen any either.
I don't know that you would. They would go straight to the ER. That's how sick they reportedly look.
Yeah, you're right. They probably end up in the ER, but I nonetheless haven't.
Still know about it.
Yeah.
You'd know about it.
Yes.
But they sent them home. They put them on airplanes with the possibility. So we brought this vaccine over. Then it spread to UC Santa Barbara. This was Thanksgiving of 14. Must have been 14, 2014. There were cases at UC Santa Barbara. There were other cases throughout the country. And they brought this new vaccine over. Now, the incidence of meningococcal meningitis in the general population, I think, is 1 out of 250,000. In college, it's estimated at 1 out of 50,000. But when it hits, it's got the highest possible profile, a complication rate that's horrendous, fatality rate that's higher than, I believe, almost any other illness you can think of. So the same thing. I don't have a problem with the vaccine. I don't have a problem giving the vaccine to college kids. But if I had my choice between saying don't smoke cigarettes or get the meningococcal meningitis, I mean, we allocate our healthcare resources both in times of the amount of time we have to spend with these kids and the money that we spend, and we allocate it towards creating and promoting a vaccine against an illness that almost nobody gets, and almost nobody got it before the vaccine. It's such an extraordinary. The vaccine, interestingly enough, has been shown to cause a rise in antibody levels. I mean, I don't remember what the criterion is. It's something like a doubling or tripling of the antibody levels in your bloodstream. But it's never been shown to prevent meningitis because the disease is too rare.
Well, but that's also a difficult study to get people to sign up for.
Study.
Can you please get exposed to meningitis
so we
can see
study.
If your vaccine worked?
The only way we could do it is we could give 10 million people a vaccine and 10 million of them a placebo and follow them for 2 years.
That is.
So it makes sense to me that it prevents meningococcal meningitis. But the allocation of our resources against an illness that is so easy to promote but really so rare. You know, it's like promoting measles at Disneyland. If that outbreak had started anywhere else but Disneyland, it would have been a blip in the New York Times. A blip. It started at Disneyland, the happiest place on earth.
Well, also a place where people come from all corners of the world.
And somebody brought that illness. I don't know whether they brought it from the Philippines or they brought it from, I don't know where it came from. But, you know, I tell people, you go to Disneyland at Christmas time, you're going to get sick. If you're unbelievably unlucky, you're going to get measles. But at the very least, you're going to catch a cold at Disneyland at Christmas time. But I wish we changed the way we spent our resources.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, now that we've gone through the whole list, am I right about that?
The routine list of you got them. Yeah. They're done. Great. We're done with that.
And for the most part, it seems like there's actually not that much disagreement about what the diseases are, what the prevalence is, how they look when you get them, how nice it would be to avoid them, and also the vaccines themselves not really, at this point, the vaccines that we use not really proven to be all that harmful. But what seems a lot different between you guys is perhaps how you discuss vaccines with your patients.
Not as different as you might think. You have gone to a fair amount of trouble to get an extraordinarily well-spoken advocate for conventional vaccination to sit here with us tonight.
Yes.
But if pressed, I would guess that you don't give all six vaccines to every two-month-old in your practice. Now, this can be edited.
Oh.
And you might not want to. What I'm saying is you don't have to touch that question. Because as soon as you say, yeah, some people get them later, some people spread them out, you are a pariah. Because you're someone on the air admitting that you. This is speaking of integrity. This doesn't go anywhere when you don't want it to. But nobody talks about that. That all pediatricians bend the rules. Schools bend the rules.
They do.
And it's you know, admit that. I mean, there are people on the west side of LA whose websites, and these are guys who get a lot more regard than I do. Who admit, you know, we have a flexible vaccine schedule. Boom! You are immediately out of compliance with the CDC, the ACIP, and the AAP, and everybody else you can think of.
My issue with condoning non-vaccination, one of many issues. So for children who are entirely unvaccinated, I do not believe I'm doing them any good. I don't believe that, number one, I'm conveying the risks and benefits adequately. Number two, I don't believe that the mothers who walk away and still want to refuse all vaccination have actually heard me. Number three, I don't believe that we can have a trusting bond. If they don't trust me about this, then when I say your child needs amoxicillin for 10 days, they'll take it for 6 days until the kid looks better and then stop. I don't believe that we are going to have a good, solid, trusting relationship. It is fundamentally against everything that I believe in terms of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure for me to say it's okay for you to not vaccinate your child at all. That scares me. I don't believe that statement. And also, for my children who come into my waiting room, my children meaning my adopted children, my patients, who come into my waiting room, and the women, the mothers who have breast cancer who are on chemotherapy, and the grandmothers who bring the grandchildren, and the women who don't even realize that they're pregnant yet, for them to come into my waiting room trusting that this is a safe environment and the kid next to them is coughing up pertussis on their newborn, I cannot condone that. I don't feel comfortable. I couldn't sleep at night knowing that that's going on in my waiting room.
Well, you can have pertussis while you're fully vaccinated. We've covered that.
Been there, done that.
But what if you establish a relationship with someone? They come to the prenatal meeting with you and they say, I really don't want to give my child any vaccines. I'm quite sure I don't want to give them any vaccines. And this is not a coin flipper. This was someone who has been exposed to nothing but Dr. Google.
This is and a you tell deal them exact, breaker for me.
And you tell them exactly how you feel, and you spend an hour with them, as you do for a prenatal discussion, I would assume, like I do, and then you see them at the hospital and for a two-week checkup. And every time you see them, they grow to trust you more. They know that you give good advice. They know that you respect what they're saying, even though you disagree. And they get vaccinated because of you.
I'll work with patients. I am not an all or none kind of person on any level. I will work with patients, but I cannot tolerate zero vaccines.
You don't have to tolerate zero vaccines.
What about that woman who wouldn't? And her poor baby got sick. On my watch, her baby got rotavirus. And I have it documented up the wazoo in the chart that I urged her every visit.
She's not going to get the vaccine if she leaves you. She's more likely to get the vaccine if you build a relationship with her.
I don't know. Not if she's come to me with predetermined ideas.
But people come with all sorts of predetermined notions.
And in the They're time raise that it takes for me to break her down, how many other children am I putting at risk?
None, quite frankly. I mean, a number that isn't a number. A number that isn't significant. Maybe you think it is. But what I'm saying is that if you build that relationship, if she leaves you. Let me tell you, she's going to seek out a doctor who, I don't know what he's doing. He could
and
be waving. He could be. Right.
They'll be more in line with each other.
Right. But her child's not going to get vaccinated because that person's going to build that relationship based on this agreement, based on this echo chamber. Whereas you have the chance because you got the facts, okay? You have the facts to build a relationship and convince someone that even if they don't get all the vaccines, take a look at this one. And after you've gotten this one, let's discuss side effects and keep going. And that's what upsets me, is that I got patients who use car seats and household safety and they're breastfeeding and they'll comply with all of these things, but they have been led to believe that vaccines are dangerous. Now, I think that, again, all medicine has some dangers and so on. But let me sit and talk with you, because I am completely accepting of people who give zero vaccines, okay? I don't wave that flag. I don't advertise. And I also take every opportunity to tell them, I've seen whooping cough, okay? I don't like it. I've seen people who went into emergency rooms without tetanus immunity and a wound that was bad enough to scare the ER doc, and it was messy. I've seen people, you know, and so on. Now, I don't try to talk people into getting vaccinated, but I think that when people are presented with the facts by a doctor with whom they have a relationship, they are more likely to get vaccinated than if you eject them from your practice. But I also, obviously, even though this is at odds, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that you do not kick people out of their practice. That's an official policy. Don't kick them out. Work with them. But how do you reconcile working with them, one AAP point of view, with all vaccines have to be given at 6 weeks of age? It lets you know that the issue is so complex. But what bothers me is that doctors like you, I haven't known you for a long time and we're not best friends.
But
doctors like you, people who could, in fact, convince an anti-vaccine person that you should look harder, open your mind. Instead, these people never get a chance to get the facts. Instead, they hear somebody talk about the dreaded formaldehyde in vaccines or that's what they hear. What?
I was assuming I knew what the next thing you were going to say was, and I had my rebuttal, but no,
that's what they hear. So they leave you where they would have gotten a responsible point of view about healthcare. Again, everything from car seats to nutrition, to household safety, to vaccines, to bike helmets, to vaccines again. And they leave you and they go somewhere where someone's just going to give them a ditto at the end of their vaccines are the devil.
They might.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
And
they
that's your choice, because it's exhausting.
Yeah, but there are lots of patients who don't come to me who already refuse vaccines. Is it my responsibility to seek them out?
Well, it's different if somebody comes to you.
But once you got them, you got them.
It's different if somebody comes to you, but you know
what? But I don't got them. If they come to me and say it's not going to happen.
No.
I read your reviews. You get 5 stars. Everybody who sees you likes you. They respect the time you spend with them. And this is real personal, okay? And you can edit this if you want. They respect you. They like you. So now you got a chance. You got a chance to talk to people who disagree with you.
When you discuss with someone
yes.
that, you know, universal vaccination or something close to that, where the patient believes that that's infringing on their personal liberties, I feel like that step over that bound is the same as, well, you should probably not eat that junk food and you should probably exercise a couple times a week and you should probably stop smoking and probably be very safe with the people that you are intimate with. How are those bits of advice any less invasive into someone's personal liberties?
They're unequivocally good medical interventions. In other words, there is no bike helmet debate. because there are no side effects from a bike helmet. The debate comes from the fact that the way we give vaccines, vaccines can create side effects. There's a small percentage of kids who, because they got vaccines, had something happen. This is acknowledged. It's nowhere near as high a percentage as they might say. It's not as low a percentage as they might say, but it's not an unequivocally perfect medical intervention. Bike helmets are almost perfect. I mean, that's so. That if someone says no, you're invading my space by telling me to have my child wear a bike helmet, leave my office, please. But if someone says, you know, I really believe that vaccines should be given later and slower, and do we really need a polio vaccine? The answer is no. You really don't need a polio vaccine. For public health reasons, maybe I could say you do. But does your child need a polio vaccine? No. Does your child need a DPT? I might say yes, your child does need a DPT. Because that's not necessarily just a public health intervention. Does your child need a Prevnar vaccine? Well, you know what? Ear infections are not trivial, neither are sinus infections. And the possibility, the extraordinarily rare possibility of pneumococcal meningitis, yeah, I'll recommend that vaccine. I'll back off on the polio vaccine because I'll bet, just like my patients, at a year or two or 3 years of age, when they contemplate travel, they think, you know, I'd like a polio vaccine. And I say, well, where are you going? They say, India. I say, India was certified a polio-free nation by the World Health Organization in February 2014. They are now on their fourth or fifth year in a row with no polio. You don't need a polio vaccine to India.
And you can guarantee that everyone on that plane is polio-free.
Not a chance. They all get the polio vaccine. I can present all the facts to them. I can say, you know, I don't know very many people who travel through India who are completely comfortable with no polio vaccination. But if you're asking me, do you have to have it for travel to India? No, you don't need it. Polio is not a plane ride away. Okay, polio is a 2 or 3 day viral illness confined at the present time to Pakistan and Afghanistan. It's not going anywhere. It's not leaving Pakistan and finding its way to San Francisco very easily. But it doesn't matter. Because a lot of vaccination is, again, very personal. Do you feel comfortable traveling to Europe without a measles vaccine? Most people would say no, because they know there's been a lot more measles. There was fatality in Germany this year. So you're traveling to Europe. Your kid's 3 years old. You didn't want vaccines. You didn't want them to have that vaccine at 12 months of age. Is it safe at 36 months of age? Yeah, I think it is.
And I think that takes us back to your quote about community, doing it for your community versus the individual.
Right.
Just like you said, you don't want someone sneezing pertussis on the newborn, and hopefully there are sick rooms and new baby rooms and things like that to kind of separate those people. You don't perhaps want what's in a vaccine in your newborn. And so just as precious and new and fantastic as that and immunocompromised as that newborn is for the virus that they could get, you also can inject them or not with something. And so parents are weighing those risks. So I think there's a chronology to answer that question. It's not all six at one time necessarily. It can be all of them over an elongated period of time. And I think most parents will go for that. The bell curve of parents will. I did a lot of research and there were so many things that I wasn't excited about giving to my children, but I did because my husband's from France. We travel internationally a few times a year. So I did it. I'm one of my pediatrician's hippie parents, but I followed her advice and we talked about it. And I bled through each one and cried, you know, even. But I did it because we had the conversations and because I looked online. And those parents will look online and get scared because it is in Europe. It is in different places that a lot of people would consider safe until you do the research. So I think most people will follow the advice, even if they don't want to originally. And you can be convinced by a trusted healthcare practitioner that listens instead of demonizes. I don't think you do demonize, but I have felt as a parent that asks questions, demonize, and you for sure as a physician, you can so easily be the pariah that you talked about, not you in general, but by even just mentioning a question, you can all of a sudden be put into this anti-vax category. And that's dangerous, I think.
But your question houses information that evidence of your investigation. You say the product insert says this. You read the product insert. Mm-hmm. You didn't get your information from Dr. Oz or from Oprah or from Parenting
Google,
Magazine or Dr. Google. Yeah.
Who speaks many
languages. So many anti-vaxxers, though, are highly educated people.
Most under-vaccinated children come from houses where the moms are white, they have an advanced education, they make over $75,000 a year. It's the those are the unvaccinated group.
Right.
The under-vaccinated group are the single Black moms who have been crossing state lines and who don't make a lot of money.
Well, but those aren't people who are choosing not to vaccinate.
Exactly.
They're lost.
Right.
It's like I said.
The unvaccinated, the ones who opt against all vaccines, tend to be in that higher echelon group.
Having had a lot of experience with this and having read probably what you've read, I can tell you that I've got a large number of people who just don't want to vaccinate according to schedule. They want to vaccinate. Some of them have said, we want our child to have every single vaccine, but they don't want six at a time.
So do you advocate waiting until they're three, like Dr. Sears does? Because, I mean, even the Surgeon General statement that you read earlier was saying that, you know, that's very dangerous. A lot of these vaccines, like the Hib, for instance, are super duper dangerous to babies.
I think the primary decision maker is the parent.
I mean, but the parent didn't go to medical school. The parent doesn't have nearly the fund of knowledge or the depth of understanding that you do. How can they be
They do. In other words, again, you don't have firsthand experience taking care of measles. I don't have firsthand experience taking care of measles. My firsthand experience taking care of meningitis is now 35 years old. Yours is 15 years old, and it involved a different patient population. So they can read the same things that we can read. They can integrate all the information. These are smart people that you and I take care of. They integrate all the information, and they say, look, I know what the pertussis vaccine does and doesn't do. And I tell people in regard to the measles vaccine that I really do believe that there can be side effects. I believe that if we stopped giving that vaccine at 12 months of age, two things would happen. Firstly, we'd lose a lot of the coincidences, you know, where kids get the vaccine and the kid was headed towards a regressive neural developmental problem within hours, weeks, or 6 weeks, and it's attributed to the vaccine. And the second thing we would lose would be the kids who are, in fact, fragile, and that triple live virus vaccine causes in them complications. No proof that increases the incidence of autism. No proof that it causes autism and so on. But I think it's acknowledged. There are some kids who get a vaccine and have complications. If we gave that vaccine later, we would retain herd immunity. We'd retain more people under our wings. You know, so yes, I would rather give that vaccine later than earlier. I would rather give vaccines spread out rather than giving them all at once. I would rather individualize. I need to listen. If someone comes into your office, prenatal visit, and they say, you know, I need to discuss nutrition with you. My husband's father died at 47 after his third heart attack. His uncles barely made it to 50. He himself has been diagnosed with plaque, and he's 37 years old. Do you have any special nutritional advice for us? And the answer is, hell yes. Your kid's a vegan with a soccer ball tied to his ankle, okay? And yet someone comes into your office and they talk about autoimmune phenomena. Two nephews with autism. Weird old Uncle Dave. Two cases of lupus and so on and so forth. It is acknowledged in the medical literature that there may be an increased incidence of type 1 diabetes. I'm not talking about Bart Clausen's articles about the Hib and diabetes, but that there are autoimmune phenomena which might be increased by vaccines. And they say, you know, we want to give vaccines, but we really would like to wait till 6 months of age. And the discussion, an honest discussion, would say you are putting your child at increased risk of whooping cough during those 4 months. The rest of the illnesses, quite frankly, is such low incidence illnesses that I don't need to talk about Hib and pneumococcus with you. You're putting your child at increased risk of pneumococcus. If you are aware of that risk and you think that the vaccines given too early or given in groups of six threaten your child, okay. I don't argue with them. I don't present a different case. I actually agree with them with skimpy scientific support, but I want to keep them.
So what do I tell my eight partners when they are the ones on call, not me that night, and they get the phone call? Do they need to say, who's your pediatrician?
You got a problem that I don't have, because you are correct. Yeah. You're not going to get eight people to agree with that, and you're certainly not
going to. You're okay taking a phone call and a fever with a two-month-old with a fever who has no vaccines?
Yeah, I've got, well, But we both know that the chances that that child has a virus as opposed to meningitis.
I like my job. I want to keep my job. I'm not willing to bank on that. We both know. I don't know.
Well, but you can tell. And if you have any doubts, you bring that child.
I'm not on the phone with them.
You bring that child. If you're worried about that child, even a child with complete vaccinations at 4 months of age and a fever, you bring that child in. That child's had a Hib vaccine and two Hibs and two Prevnars and two DTaps. You bring that child, that febrile four-month-old, into your office, and you probably meet them at the office at midnight if you have to, or find good good after-hours care. Because you don't sit on a four-month-old, fully vaccinated kid with a fever who doesn't look good to its parents. So that argument, which I have heard many times before, I don't think is valid, because that's not how a good doctor practices. You've had all your shots. Give him some Tylenol, call me in the morning. It's a four-month-old with a 103-degree fever, not looking good to his parents. Uh-uh. Not buying it. And if you've got eight partners, who would do that?
No, my partners are solid doctors. I'm not worried about that.
Now, they would be more concerned and angrier, perhaps, if that child had no vaccines, because now I got to go through a differential that I thought I had put to rest in 1988. I got to go through the differential with Hib. But, you know, if you are... a well-read, intelligent doctor, you know that Hib meningitis is incredibly rare, as is pneumococcal meningitis. But, you know, it could happen in a fully vaccinated kid, less likely. It could happen in an unvaccinated kid. You're going to see that kid.
So I'm going to tell you, just on a personal note, you were talking about autoimmune disease. I have a nephew who is, I don't know if the word profoundly is accurate, he is autistic.
Mm-hmm.
He will not function on his own as an adult. He's a teenager now. This is my brother's son. Two of my own children, one has ADHD, one has autoimmune urticaria, and then another one has Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune disease. They're fully vaccinated. I don't think, in my heart of hearts, in my brain of brains, I don't have any inkling that their illnesses are at all related to vaccines.
What kind of a mean son of a bitch would imply that they are? Okay. Who would imply that? Anybody who said, when he hears about someone, a child who has autism, you say, was he vaccinated? What, are you crazy? How about saying, how can I help? You know. But what I'm saying is that if you have a family history of autoimmune issues, I really think that vaccines, given the way we give them, create a risk that's 2%, 11%, I don't know. I'm not going to pull a number out of my ear. All I'm saying is that you are entitled to discuss vaccines because, boy, if you've got that family history as you have, and yours isn't even an awful family history,
yeah.
It's not fun, but you're pretty well read.
I would love for this conversation to go on forever, but I promised you both it wouldn't, and your plane is about to pull away.
Your plane's going to take off.
I would like to just finish with one thing. Any resources that you recommend for vaccine research?
I like the CDC, the AAP. The CDC is the Centers for Disease Control. The American Academy of Pediatrics is the AAP. The ACIP, the Academy for... what's the C for?
Immunization Practices.
Those, of course, will be biased in one direction, obviously, but I bet you Dr. Gordon has some others.
I have trouble, you know. I like the NVIC. I think that they present a lot of information, but it's not unbiased information. And
it's biased in the other direction.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of great, I tell people, find a doctor you trust, talk to the doctor.
Sounds like a great idea.
And I also tell them, and this is, I tell people.
About Barbara Lowe Fisher, the NVIC?
Yeah.
So Barbara Lowe Fisher's a non-doctor who believes that her son was harmed through vaccination.
Yes.
And she started this group that she named the National whatever it is, so that it sounded like it was a government institution. But that is certainly going to be biased in one direction.
They're nothing but biased. That's why I said I'm not going to say if you want to know about vaccines,
but
read the NVIC.
It's a .org. And yet she makes a profit.
what I'm saying is that I don't have a good place to send people for unbiased information.
Right. They're pediatrician.
And find a doctor you trust.
Yeah.
Find a doctor you trust.
That's the
read as much
message.
As you can.
Thank you very much for listening to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting podcast. You can find out information and resources from the things we talked about today at informedpregnancy.com on the show notes page for this vaccine. I would like to thank Dr. Gordon, Dr. Wilbur, and Maria for joining us today. And if you have any questions at all, feel free to write to info@informedpregnancy.com.
I got a whole lot of questions for you. This kid's gonna test my will. I got a lot to learn and my baby's due.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike. Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby, not even diaper rash.